Masters of the Air. I couldn't find any criticism online of this show, you know, no bad reviews or anything like that, which I found quite interesting.
I found a pretty scathing New York Times article.
Okay, well, can you summarise? Can you give it to me? What's the summary?
The pacing was wrong. It felt as though they'd mixed up the reels with like the way that the story developed and things that like came into the story and then were dropped out. And also there was a minor point about Britain, like Great Britain being omitted from the war. And that's about it, really, I think. There were artistic criticisms on there, I think.
That's that's really interesting because I think this has been very well received other than that. I feel like, you know, some of these critiques, they try and find anything to provide an alternative view, right?
I think we're quite nice generally. We're not critics anyway, so
we're not critics, but I think when something's bad, we let the clip off. I have this saying that, you know, even if a film's bad, it's still a film, and a lot of work went into it. So sometimes I'm a little bit nicer because of that. Like, well, you know, at least they got together and made a film.
Like, you'd rather it existed than it didn't, sort of thing.
But this was very much more than a bad TV series or anything like that. I thought it was really good.
Yeah,
I actually loved. I'm a big fan of detail, and I actually really loved how detailed the missions, you know, were put out to the audience. How detailed the experience was when they were up in the planes. And the horror, this is one of those shows, I got a little desensitized to horror, unfortunately, towards the end.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was because it was just happening so often. It was massively impactful. You know, in your article, you talk about killing off someone. and Masters of the Air, you know, killed off so many.
Well, I think that was what really struck me about this. I was having a look through the cast earlier. Americans have some crazy names, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Total tangent. I was watching that Turning Point documentary about the Cold War recently.
Right.
You know, at one point in their dealings with Russia, a US ambassador, I believe he was the ambassador to Yugoslavia, his name was Larry Eagleburger.
They're very grand, aren't they, the names?
But like, imagine,
and a bit like ironic, like, you know, when you generate a name.
Generate cliche name. Me an American name. Yeah, like, imagine you're a Russian, like your average Russian bloke, you know, getting fed all this like propaganda about the US by, I don't know, whichever president, whoever was in charge of Russia at the time, Gorbachev or someone, and it's like, oh yeah, and we're speaking with Larry Eagleburger. Like, it's like, you know, ridiculous. Anyway, Masters of the Air, I was looking through the cast, and like everybody that I saw, you know, all these names, I don't know them, I don't recognise them from the show, and I think this is intentional. You get to a point where you stop bothering, after like two or three episodes, you know, you learn what this is going to be like. You stop bothering trying to remember their names and faces because you know they're not going to last long.
Yeah.
And that in itself, like, as you know, the show makes you as an audience member do that. You sort of give up on trying, like being like, oh, which one's that again? Like, you don't even think like that. Everybody's kind of becomes disposable in a way. And, you know, that point kind of reiterates what these men experienced in the show, because they talk about some of the pilots not bothering to get to know the new guys when they come in, because it's like, well, it just reminds us of people that we've lost, and there's no point getting to know them because we're just gonna have to go through that hurt again.
Yeah.
So they just kind of became like impersonal on the base because everybody's just dying.
Yeah.
And you know, you're up there in these planes like in oxygen masks, like in the action scenes when they're fighting, you can't see who's who really. Like, you're relying on like hearing stuff over the like radios.
I kept trying to identify people based on their eyebrows.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like, you know, people are yelling, oh, like so and so's dead, and you're like, I don't even know who that is. Like, you're waiting for a scene when they've landed back at the base. Thorpe, what's it called? What's the base called? In England. No, I can't remember.
I just know it was in Norwich.
Yeah. It'd land back there and you'll come off the plane and you're like, oh, right, you know, is it... You like, you know, you worked out who's died based on who's not come back.
Yeah.
And that's like how you know almost. Yeah. And I imagine that was probably true to an extent. Like,
and he shoots. And do you know, all the way through the show, I was like, wow, the amount of people just willing to jump out of the plane.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine the majority of the population willing to jump out of a plane now.
Well, is it the majority? It's not the majority.
Well, millions of people that are just jump out of the plane. It's nothing.
Yeah. Who probably have never done or only done that once or twice before.
In training, yeah. I found everything very... you can never really know if something's historically accurate, but it felt like the effort was really made to get as close to accuracy as possible, which I really appreciate.
I think it was quite historically accurate because it's based on the novel, Donald L. Miller, which I'd love to read, actually, now I've watched this.
Yeah.
And I think it's, considered quite a historically accurate novel. Mm. And I think, a lot of effort, as you say, has gone into the historical accuracy.
Yeah.
Of course, you get, the true stories of the characters at the end. The last episode.
Which I found really, really harrowing because episode 4, I really realised this was a true story because there's a documentary that's been released at the same time about the 100th Bombardiers. And when I was going through the true stories of the survivors at the end, I was sitting there going, wow, I've just sat through something that was actually just completely real. There's not really much fiction to what, Egan and Clevens went through.
Yeah.
Is
Buck and Bucky, right?
Buck and Bucky. Is what factually correct?
Yeah.
I think
Rosie Rosenthal is probably the craziest.
Yeah.
The dude did his 25 missions.
And then did another 27.
And in the first mission, that was the... I forgot, it wasn't Regensburg, it was the one after.
Where one plane returned.
Where he was the only plane that came back. And that was his first mission.
Yeah.
His first three were
three in 3 days.
Yeah.
And they originally were months apart. I mean, it's just insane how... the frequency of missions just changed halfway through.
And Rosie's, of course, he completes his 25 and then discovers that they're upping the limit to 30. Everyone after him is going to have to do 30 missions before, they're granted rotation home. And he decides, he's not going. He's got this survivor guilt in a way, I guess. And he refuses and he does another 27 missions, survives the war, becomes a lawyer, and then goes to Nuremberg.
Prosecutes Nazis.
And doesn't just prosecute Nazis, he prosecutes the head of the Luftwaffe.
Yeah.
The man orchestrating the acts of the people they're fighting in the sky. I mean, his life. And then goes on to become, the best dad ever. He's involved in, PTAs at every school his kid ever even touched. the guy, it was just incredible. What a life.
Yeah.
And this, he's done his first mission and he's the only plane that returns. He doesn't want to go on R&R leave because he's got this sense of duty and he doesn't want to deal with the survivor guilt. He does his 25 missions, comes back to do another 27 or something, and then at some point is shot down over Berlin and he's lost guys on his plane and he wants to keep the plane steady and in the air as long as he can. So the people parachuting out aren't landing in Berlin.
Mm.
He bails himself, obviously, being shot down, he pulls his chute and lands in no man's land somewhere outside Berlin, right between the Russian and German forces fighting. I mean, and survives this. He gets taken on by the Russian forces and sent home. I mean, what this guy went through in the war.
Mm.
And of course, he's one of many.
Something really... shocking as well was his experience while traveling with the Russians, where they came across a concentration camp.
Mm.
So, and these soldiers didn't know what the Germans were actually doing.
Now we are onto already the one area that I would criticize this show for. I'm not sure if that happened. I haven't read the book. I don't know. I'm not sure if Rosie Rosenthal, when he was shot down and being looked after by the Russians, that he actually did come across evidence of a concentration camp. and all, you know, all the bodies. That may have just been added in as a kind of, if you like, a sort of like moral justification for the actions of the heroes for the audience.
Mm.
You know, like a reminder for the audience, this is what it was all.
Because it hadn't been mentioned at all throughout.
Yeah, and in fairness, that makes sense, because of course, you're right, like, these guys didn't know what they were doing. These guys didn't know, like, at this point, that what the Germans were up to during the Second World War, and what Hitler's regime, like, was to it in its full extent. But it felt a bit kind of, for want of a better word, like, shoehorned in. If Rosie Rosenthal genuinely did, like, that happened, he, you know, was with the Russian army waiting for a flight back to, I don't know, Poland or somewhere so we could get back to England, and he did just happen to come across it, like, fair enough, it, you know, it's in there for historical reasons. But it felt a bit kind of, like, obligatory,
mm.
You know? It was like, oh, like, here's the scene of...
One of those moments in a show of less qualities, say, where there's, you know... It's almost exposition,
in a way. Yeah. It just felt a bit like...
This is why it's happening.
Yeah. It has to be here.
Yeah.
And, of course, in a way, it does. Because you might be tempted to criticise it if they hadn't touched on the Holocaust. You know, what was going on in Russia at this point, 1945 and onwards, under Stalin's regime, was just as bad. I mean, he killed almost 25 million of his own people in his 30 years in office. I mean, that's kind of staggering. And, like, the Gulag Archipelago, like, spanned across all of Europe, well, all of Russia, of course, and, like, the Baltic states, Siberia. I thought the Russian, you know, translator who was with Rosie at that moment, I thought his reaction was interesting, because he sort of nonchalantly is like, oh yeah, these are the death camps, we've been finding these. I wonder if he is aware of what's going on in his own country and what happens to him if he shows even the tiniest bit of disloyalty in his job at this point. But the bit that was especially sketchy for me was when Rosie is talking to the old Polish man.
Yeah.
And he decides, with almost no prompting, to just, you know, tell Rosie his entire story. The story of his family being shot and him having to bury them, you know, by the Nazis. All translated by a convenient English speaker standing next to him. That just felt like it came out of nowhere.
Mm,
like, he was like, oh, where are you going now? And this guy was like, I'm just going to tell you my whole story. Like, right after the trauma of it. Did you catch what he said? He said, where are you going now?
I can't remember.
It wasn't translated and it wasn't subtitled. He said Palestine.
Oh, no, yes, I did get that. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. I did.
Mm.
I wasn't sure I heard it right.
Mm. Yeah. I'm a tiny, tiny bit, like, you know, we've got to be really careful discussing this, obviously, but, like, I'm a tiny bit concerned that in that moment, that was a very subtle connection between the Holocaust, an intentional connection made between the Holocaust and all of the horror that, you know, these men were fighting for, over, about, to solve in Masters of the Air, and, of course, the displacement of the Jewish people to Palestine and what's happening now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the same...
I think the show's finished before October, though. As in, they'd finished making this show before October.
Regardless, you know?
Yeah, it was subtle, but it was like everyone knew what that meant at that time. So
it felt like an intentional link drawn between the events of the show and present day, and I wonder why that would, in a scene that already felt a little bit shoehorned in, a little bit unrealistic.
Well, there's no smoke without fire now, and then you've got kind of two things that didn't really feel like they fit.
And unfortunately, I think this is this kind of thing that happens when you get war movies, or, you know, I know this arguably isn't a war, well, it is a war series, right?
Mm.
When Darkest Hour came out, you know, the Churchill thing, Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
I mean, that came around right before the Brexit vote, didn't it?
Yeah.
Is that true? I can't remember. I'm not sure on the dates of that. But it came around right, you know, at a pivotal moment in...
Yeah, where patriotism was required.
Yeah, a dose of patriotism, a dose of, like, do you remember, like, when we overcame the Nazis, you know? Which, scarily, is the same thing that leads a lot of the Russian rhetoric and, like, their own self-identity comes from their defeat of the Nazis as well. So scary. It's scary, like, it's this place in sort of the wider thinking of society is a little bit maybe sketchy. But that's my one criticism.
Something interesting, I've got two interesting things. There were five directors, and I kind of want to talk about why there were five directors. One of them was Kari Joji Fukunaga, who we spoke about probably last episode on True Detective. Kari was the director in True Detective season one.
Yeah. I didn't make that connection. Yeah.
And actually has pedigree here. Now, I looked into some of his other work. Kari produced and wrote a film about an African child soldier.
Oh my god. And like, what was it called?
It came out in 2015, and it was called Beasts of No Nation.
I've seen it. Idris Elba.
Yeah, and I saw just before I came out that Idris Elba's in it and thought, I need to watch that
film. Oh, it's harrowing.
Yeah.
It's tough. Like, it's even worse. It's worse
than are there similarities in the cinematography?
No, but I guess it would be hard for there to be similarities, given that one is obviously... They're very different settings. Mm. And the setting, obviously, of like aerial combat is, you know, and even those scenes on the ground, 1940s Paris or, you know, Germany or an air base, it's very obviously different to a more modern day Africa, Republic of Congo or something. But I mean, you know, the way that they approach the subject matter is probably quite similar. Mm. Like, it's harrowing. It's really, really difficult to watch. There's some scenes that, like, genuinely, you know, take you a day or two to recover from.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, yeah, they cut deep. Yeah.
So he's got pedigree. He's got pedigree on White Blacklist.
Yeah.
And I'll definitely be trying to watch Beast of No Nation at some point when I've recovered from all of this horrible stuff we've watched. But five directors. I mean, my justification in my head is that there's an argument to use directors to film different things that you want to see on screen or that you want from the piece of work.
I think that's probably true, yeah.
But is that unique, five directors? It feels like that's quite unique.
In a series as short as this, maybe. But then you think about it, you know, the Harry Potter series, very different, of course. They came out over a longer period of time. But that had four directors?
Mm. Multiple directors over a short space of time, to me, sparks chaos. Remember The Idol, when it was six episodes, and they, you know, all changed hands midway through. And is there something... That just doesn't make sense to me, because it was Kerry did four, and then four other directors did an episode each.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the directors that worked on this are you know, pretty highly regarded.
Mm.
And you can tell, because the quality is pretty, like, really high throughout. And of course, you know, you've got Spielberg and Tom Hanks at the helm of this. So, like, it was always going to succeed to an extent.
Yeah.
And it's based on, you know, a successful and historically accurate novel. Like, it's a pretty tight foundation to build, like, this story on, to put, you know, this project on. It was always going to be pretty good. I think maybe because of how different the scenes are, you know, see episode three, for example, the Regensburg raid, there's a lot of aerial combat. Mm. There's a lot of people getting shot to pieces in planes, and it's tough to watch. But that's very different to the later episodes, you know, nine, for example, where a lot of it takes place on the ground. A lot of it is, you know, our heroes, like, getting marched around, moving from camp to camp by, like, the guards and stuff, because the Allies are approaching on their prisoner of war camps. I mean, the setting is drastically different, what's happening is really different. And of course that final episode's when they're liberated and there's like an uprising in the camp and you've got Sherman tanks rolling across and you got a, what were the planes, P-51s or something?
P-51s,
and yeah. And everyone's, you know, overthrowing the guards. That's of course another completely different like stylistic requirement, isn't it? And of course that episode was directed by Tim Van Patten, who was also really highly regarded, I think, like for scenes like that, you know. So maybe, you know, a number of different directors working on different parts of the show, different episodes that were stylistically different, kind of makes sense. And maybe contributed to it, to why it's so good.
So on the blog that you've written on our website, you mention Barry Keoghan's character Kurt Biddick's death, and you know, I completely agree with how impactful that was, but I found at the end of episode 4 when Buck Clevens was supposed to have died, I didn't find that very impactful at all. And I actually found the Bubbles death in episode 5 way more impactful. And obviously they were building Buck Clevens from the start of the season. Now, I'm at episode 4 going, oh, Buck's dead, just because he just didn't return home.
Yeah.
I get it. But I didn't feel anything. And obviously he wasn't actually dead, but I didn't know that at the end of episode 4. But when Kroz is reading the letter that Bubbles had written on his behalf,
oh yeah,
because Bubbles thought he had died, that was really, really hard hitting. And Bubbles was barely an afterthought in this show.
Yeah.
So
he's actually one of those I couldn't tell you what he looked like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But my thing there is, I felt at times that they didn't get certain decisions quite right. And is it because Buck wasn't actually dead? Because to me, it looks like they really committed to his death at the end of episode 4 with Egan in London, and he gets the phone call, yeah, and it's all really down. And I was just like, I didn't really feel it. And I don't know if you felt it.
So I actually started writing this article after episode 4, and I finished it just after episode 7. okay, that's not true. I conceived the idea. I was like, I want to talk about that death in episode 3. Kurt Biddick, of course, Barry Keoghan. And then episode 4 happens, and Cleven is killed off,
mm-hmm,
off camera.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like one of the two main protagonists.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, have they actually done this? Because I was so shaken by Biddick's death that I genuinely believe that like anyone could die, and I think that's why they, you know, why they included that death, as I sort of talk about in the article. Biddick's death represents the death of everybody.
Yeah,
like if he can die, no one's safe.
Yeah,
this is the big sort of like, you know, emotional, out of the blue. Like this is us getting used to the concept of people just dying around you, right? From now on, we're not going to see it. You're just going to hear it. Do you know what I mean? And like, there was a character introduced,
and then Rosie came in. Rosenthal came in.
Rosenthal comes in to replace them. And you
think, okay, so they're just going to rotate.
Exactly.
People are going to die. They're just going to rotate new people that you have to try and get behind.
And as an audience member, I'm thinking, I'm not even going to bother to remember their name. There's that guy who has the sort of relationship developed with a girl on the base, and it's like, you know, he's like witty, like flirty with her, and then course he comes back from a mission and one of his mates just goes up to her and is like, oh sorry, he didn't make it, and that's it. And that's how almost how Gale is treated, because he just doesn't come back from that mission on the 4th episode. And I genuinely was thinking like, they've done that, they've killed him off screen. And I was pretty upset with that, because I think, you know, if he's one of your heroes, like you really should, do you know what I mean, like put some weight into his death, like they did with Biddick's death at Regensburg. But I mean, I was like, well, maybe it just makes sense because it's the motivation behind John Egan's character, behind Bucky. And maybe this is historically accurate, maybe this is genuinely what happens.
Yeah.
Then of course you get the payoff when Bucky goes down and he has all of this experience, you know, locked up by the Germans, prisoner of war, and he's transferred to a camp and he's coming in and some guys recognize him and he's looking around and he goes, does anyone know if Buck made it? And then of course you Buck's hear his there. Voice
yeah.
and he's like 2 o'clock and looks around and there he is in his jacket like looking all cool and it's like, and that really paid off for me, that really yeah. worked. It felt predictable,
right?
Like I kind of knew it was happening. Oh, like I guess in hindsight you could say, oh no, that's really like cliche, you know, pretending to kill off one of your heroes only to reunite them a couple of episodes later. Like, it's predictable. And that's what that New York Times article claimed. They were like, oh, it was this sort of tired, predictable kind of story trope. But I was aware, because of Biddick's death, specifically because of Biddick's death, this was just portraying history. There wasn't going to be any like attempt to drag a powerful narrative story out of it. It was just, this is what happened, this is what these guys went through.
And as you said, it didn't discriminate.
Exactly. So if Gale went down, you know, if Biddick can be killed off like a red shirt, then so can Gale.
Yeah.
And that could potentially have happened. So up until Bucky sees him come like in the camp, in my head he could still have been dead. I was, and through all of this, you know, the writers really put me in the, like, the position of these men.
Yeah.
And I think that's what this show consistently did so well. Yeah. Like, everything about it, it really like put you there. It was really immersive. Even the fact that the combat scenes were more often than not shot from inside a plane. Like, the camera is placed inside it.
Yeah.
You're in the cockpit, you're in the middle bit where like the machine guns are, you know, you're in like the tail gun with these guys, you're in there with the guy looking at the map trying to work things out as like empty shell casings are bouncing around him and flats going off. Like, it's not this Top Gun action sequence where you're seeing planes fly around shooting each other down. Like, you're in the plane.
Yeah.
I don't really know a movie that's done that before.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, everything, including like the story pivots and the narrative like moments, were all chosen based off of history and in a way that genuinely just kept you guessing. Like, I think you were always supposed to be a little bit unsure.
It's crazy what moments resonate with you the most, because even Biddick's, like, I was shook by Biddick's, but I knew Bubbles was in She's Gonna, the plane,
right?
And then when I, that line where they went, when one of the crew went, oh my god, She's Gonna is getting obliterated.
Yeah.
And Bubbles and Croz at the base had some interaction about She's Gonna.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you like to know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there was that implant into the brain that She's Gonna is significant.
Yeah.
And then when you see She's Gonna just get up in flames,
yeah,
you know Bubbles is in there. Bubbles is reading that letter. I mean, that was unbelievable for me. That was the hardest hitting death for me. And so, and it's just interesting, you know, maybe the Gale Clevin's death, or you know, air quotation marks, death did really resonate with some people. It kind of did
with me. Like, what the scene that I remember from all of that, you know, from his death and non-death, is of course the reuniting of the two of them when he comes into the camp. Like,
yeah,
oh, that was great.
That paid off.
Yeah, me, there was like this whole like dump of hope on you at that point. Like, this whole like, maybe they are going to get through this, like, damn. Like, because right up until the very end, you know, that machine gun starts going off in the camp, I was thinking, oh, like, Bucky's getting killed, one of them's dying, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And right up until the credits, literally right at the end, when there's obviously this cathartic like sense of ending and victory, Bucky, Buck, Rosie, Croz, and the mechanic who's never got in a plane before, all get in a plane together. And I was thinking, like, you've just put everyone that still matters and everyone that we care about in the same plane. Like, that it's going down, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was expecting almost, literally even after the credits rolled, I was expecting, like, you know, white on black, like, the plane crashed and no one were ever seen again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a historical, you know, truth at the end.
Yeah.
And you're actually just telling the story of all of these guys that didn't make it. And I didn't know right up until the end, right up until you get the, like, you know, the context at the end about the genuine guys that it's about.
And I think as well, in the back of your mind, you also know that the Americans are still fighting the Japanese.
Well, yeah, of course.
Even when the show ends.
Yeah.
And one of those true stories, one of them went to fight in Vietnam as well. Was that Rosenthal?
No, it was Bucky, it was John Egan.
Went to fight in Vietnam as well.
Yeah.
It's just...
That's just nuts, yeah. Yeah, I mean, living through like the 1900s, there were so many wars.
Yeah,
like the conflict is just staggering in that century. And Bucky pretty much went went to all of them, didn't he? Like, it's ridiculous. I think another factor that played into the deaths being so poignant was decisions with the cinematography. You put in the plane, as I say, like during most of these like combat missions. But when you see a plane go down, you're not in it. Do you know what I mean? The camera sees it get like shot to pieces, but like burst into flame, whatever. There's that real sense of powerlessness. Like, you know, you're seeing the plane go down like with your friend on it. You know what I mean? Like, it, the sense of powerlessness with it, the sense of like it being completely beyond your control, just like with Biddick's death, when he like, you know, in the last seconds he realizes like he is not going to land this plane, he's got no chance. Like, that's where the horror is, I think.
Yeah.
Like, the realization this is just beyond your control, and like survival is random. That's really scary.
Yeah. Oh, Nikita Gatwe getting in at the end as well. Just really, I mean, prominent upcoming stars in this. And
When he came in, I was like, what can this man not do? Like, this is incredible.
But he didn't do much.
He did nothing.
Yeah.
And that wasn't his fault, of course. But like, I did feel it was really weird. And in this, I agree with that New York Times article about it feeling like they'd mixed the reels up. They showed up in like what, the second or third to last episode?
Episode 8, yeah.
Episode 8, the penultimate episode, like the Tuskegee Airmen show up and it's like really cool, you know, you see one mission with them, half of them get shot down, and then they end up in the POW camp like with Buck and Bucky, and that's it. And then one of them's integral to the escape, Jefferson, who amazingly survived to 100 years old and died in 2022 while this TV series was in production, which is really cool. And then that like Nakuta Gatwa is completely dropped out of the last episode. Like, you know, he's a background character. Yeah. I mean, Nakuta Gatwa, he doesn't even need to be there.
Yeah.
Like, he's not, you know, if you took Shuri Gatwa out completely, it doesn't change, unfortunately. I guess what I'm saying is I'd like to have seen more of him, and more of the Tuskegee Airmen as well. There were a few things that were sort of introduced and then just dropped really randomly. Mm. The whole spy thing.
Oh yeah.
Crosses date.
Sandra.
Who obviously is revealed to be, I can't remember. Oh, but it's obviously revealed to be a spy.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell was that all for?
That sound looked like a really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course the other one was the fate of William Quinn, who is, you know, he goes down in an early episode. I think it might have been episode 3 actually. I'm not sure. Babyface is trapped in the turret. He can't save him. He goes down and he's the first guy you see, you know, parachute into German territory. And of course he's there, you know, enemy lines and all of that. And he gets picked up by a farmer. Oh, he's in Belgium, isn't he? Anyway, you sort of get led into thinking that you're going to follow his escape, like the story of his escape. And he's on a train and, you know, he nearly bolts at one point and he's got to provide fake documentation. He's trying to get back to England, like... The farmer gives them a choice, you know, you can either go to a prisoner of war camp and you'll probably survive the war, or you can try and escape, but like if you get caught you're dead. And it's like really built up and really dramatic, and then it ends with like him on the train. It's like, are they going to get out? Next episode you just see him biking back into Thorpe Abbott. I've remembered it. You just see him bike back in, like, oh yeah, got back. And everyone's like, oh nice one, you get to go home now. And it was like that got cut off right at the high point of the tension. I understand, you know, this is a timing issue. You can't tell the full story of all of them.
But there's lots of interesting stories.
But I feel like you could have explored more, yeah.
Yeah. My final point relates to the theme tune. Now, this happens... I sometimes think it's not important, but I'd love a good theme. And I think this was perfect.
Really?
I thought the musical score in this was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
It felt like it sounded like what you were watching.
Yeah. You know? Give me that.
And I actually, you know, one of my biggest problems almost the funniest issues I've ever had with theme music is The Wire changing its theme tune every season.
It doesn't well, yeah. It's the same like, tune. It's
I think it gets slightly worse every single season.
Yeah.
but no, I really actually love a good theme tune. And obviously, like, streaming services have almost rendered theme music used, like, not important because you just skip intro.
Yeah.
But no, I do like a good theme that matches what you're watching, and I thought this was definitely. I mean, look at the criticism around True Detective just using a Billie Eilish song.
That was a bit cheap because it's obviously a very overused track. But again, I'll say it as I said in the True Detective episode. It adds a lot if it's good, but it takes nothing away if it's bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you. Like in this case, it was really appropriate.
Maybe we need a rating scale for theme tunes that we've heard.
Oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that.